Hello. Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to be here following all these outstanding talks which have been given previously. I'm going to change a little bit of focus and talk a little bit more about some of my own personal experiences and lessons learned from some of the risk analysis which I have been involved in. Of course, a lot of this risk analysis which I'm going to talk about is very, very closely tied with all kinds of public policy issues. And specific examples, which I have been personally involved in, are all kinds of things related to risk. I was greatly involved in terms of examination of Challenger disaster. Obviously, Challenger disaster was a large impact, covered almost a decade of not flying, but it affected only a single program. While another new territory which we are looking at is in terms of terrorism, with a great deal of danger of terrorism. There has been a great interest in terms of detection of illicit nuclear material, which might be going across the boundaries and may be used in terms of making dirty bombs. And it's very different in terms of its large impact across multiple sites, but has never happened before. And the last one, which actually I was involved in terms of developing a major business opportunity, which was related to all kinds of network and software risk, which are huge combinatorial explosion with all kinds of network contagion, which spread very, very quickly around the world. At the same time, I think we have learned a lot from last 20 years in terms of how to contain it, how to deal with it, and so on. So I'm not going to talk about that particular issue, but that's something which always should be kept in mind in terms of the contagion part of it. And the two lessons I'm just going to say to start off is that it's not enough just to have computing power. It's really critical to have real data, with data which is quality data, which has got very carefully analyzed, deeper domain knowledge. And given that we are dealing with really highly uncertain events, the corresponding statistical thinking is very, very critical. Obviously, the key risk analysis issue is always, how do you find that this is going to be important or not? Where is that black swan? And that's always going to be a challenge, and partly going to be art. And the other one is that given that we are looking at situations which have not happened before, how can I pull information from a variety of other sources, and how do I combine them in some fashion to come up with some sort of answer and come up with some sort of quantification of answer itself? So let's start a little bit first with revisiting a question of Challenger disaster. Going back to January 27th, 1986, night of that. The next day, Challenger was going to take off with a teacher on board, and the expected temperature was around 31 degrees. And earlier, all the flights had at least 50 degrees and above temperature. And the question which was being raised at that night in midnight conversation between NASA and their chief supplier of the solid rocket motors was that should it be safe to launch or not? And specific concern was related to O-rings, which were used in terms of solid rocket motor. And there were wide-varying opinions, very heated debate. Roger Bazalgette, who used to be chief engineer for Morton Thiokol, was dead set against launching it off, and he claimed the temperature was indeed a discriminator. And NASA, with all its careful planning, at the same time wanting to finish the mission, decided to look at real data, and based on the real data, which I'm going to show you shortly, suggested that temperature data was not conclusive, and let's launch. And that was the official decision which came out from Morton Thiokol as a contractor here itself. And the data they looked at it is the following kind of data. So every flight of shuttle has got basically 12 O-rings. And what we have here is on the vertical axis number of O-rings which were potentially distressed in some manner versus the corresponding temperature itself. And if you look at it, it looks a little bit more like U-shaped, and consequently it was decided that there was no temperature effect and we should just start and launch it because it doesn't look like there is a temperature effect. And obviously we know what happened on the next day, which was the explosion of Challenger. And a huge amount of hue and cry were made, and huge amount of lots of work was done in terms of investigation by Rogers Commission. And it turned out that Rogers Commission came up with a striking conclusion which was based on data which was completely missed before, And that was this data, where in fact, in the original picture, every flight we did not have any incidents were completely dropped off. Consequently, now once you look at this picture, then it's clear that as you increase the temperature, flights having zero incidents go up substantially. Consequently, clearly there is a temperature effect itself. So this was really the basic issue. At the same time, there was a challenge from Rogers Commission that even just looking at this picture, people could still launch off. Is there any way to quantify it? And could we have quantified before the launch of the Challenger disaster itself? And that was a task which was given to a few of us from National Research Council. And this is where the whole work was done in terms of probabilistic models and related things. So if we were to think about some sort of model, obviously, first thing, as I always said, is that you need to have domain knowledge. So let's take a look at the design of the space shuttle as it was done around that time. Here is on the left side is the picture of the shuttle here itself. Number one is nothing but the orbiter. Number two is nothing but liquefied hydrogen tank itself, fuel tank. And number three and four are nothing but solid rocket motors. And solid rocket motors were really basically fitted from four components in the field itself, and therefore they were joined at the arrows by joints in the field itself. And those joints to be making sure that they were working fine, variety of techniques were used where O-rings got in. And so right side picture actually shows you the design of the how the joints were made. Joints were made by what is known as tang and clevis kind of joint here itself. So you put one part in the other part itself, and consequently there could be a potential gap through which gases can escape under the pressure as the solid rocket fuel starts burning. So there was a putty in the side here, and then there are O-rings. And the idea was that as the pressure increased, putty will force the O-rings, and O-rings will get energized, and the whole system would completely become foolproof. There were some challenges here, because obviously with the huge amount of pressure, the metal will start moving a little bit. And as it moves a little bit, the fields would start rotating. And there were lots of concerns which were raised about field rotations and other related things. But for our purposes, it's just worth noting that there were actually two O-rings you can see. There is a primary O-ring and secondary O-ring. And typically, a failure would occur if both of those O-rings fail in some fashion. How could they fail? They would fail if there is an erosion in the primary O-ring, and after erosion, some air blows by and goes to the secondary O-ring. And its secondary O-ring also erode, and secondary O-ring also starts now failing, and the air and gases come out of it. That's the way a scenario of a particular joint failing. And it was known that if one joint fails, then the whole shuttle was going to collapse. So it was really at least one joint failing is what was of interest to here. And that in this particular engineering design. So given that now, one can now start thinking about that, given all this, how can we think about some sort of probabilistic calculation? And that was a challenge posed by Rogers Commission. Could we have predicted in some fashion, looking at only the data which was available before that and nothing after that? And that was the challenge. And of course, now going back to some sort of simple probabilistic calculus, we can now start thinking about that how could a particular joint fail because of O-ring failure. And therefore, you can now start writing down the chain here itself. The chain would be that primary has to erode, and then blow-by has to occur, blow-by meaning the air would blow by. Secondary has to erode, and secondary has to blow by. And now, of course, we can now start writing down a conditional probabilities of various types, and here are the conditional probabilities written down. And that's nothing but a probability of failure of one joint, and of any given joint. But probability of total failure would occur if at least one joint failed. And therefore, you have got the probability which you can write down this kind of calculus here very simply here itself. Of course, the biggest challenge here is now, given all this, the idea is now to break down a bigger complex event in terms of a number of granular parts and start thinking about the granularity itself. And now the question is that how would one predict such a thing? How could we have predicted in some fashion? No accidents had occurred up to this flight. So the biggest challenge was this. And I won't go into the detail. They're all in the published papers which I have. But the most interesting was that there were huge amount of sources of information which was available and which was actually discussed in the call, which were related to a variety of different joints, lab experiments, pressure, partial degradation data, which you saw some of the distress O-ring and so on and so forth. And the idea was to connect it up in some fashion and use probability calculus to propagate uncertainty throughout this whole thing to come up with some estimate of all of this. And I'll just give you the answer here, which turns out to be that if we were to look at this probability of failure of the whole spatial due to a failure in O-rings in one joint here itself, it turns out that on the left side is nothing but a probability distribution of at 31 degrees, and it turns out that the mean of this distribution turns out to be around 16%. And if they had waited, for example, to go up to 60 degrees, which was going to occur in the after a few hours, then in that particular case, the probability would have gone down to less than 1% here itself. So clearly, there was a huge amount of things which could have been done and which could have helped potentially, and this was the key part of great debate occurring that night. And, of course, there are public policy questions that there was a teacher first time on board, and every school in the United States was watching. All the school kids were watching teacher going up and blowing up at that particular point in time. Was it worth, should a teacher be sent on such a mission? And so on, are all kinds of open questions. But the key lessons, as you can see, is thinking about some sort of just going to the right granularity and then collecting and fusing information from a variety of sources and making sure whether the models are robust or not robust. This is the challenge always whenever you do modeling, that are these going to be robust or not, is something which was very, very critical. Let me turn on to now a next example, which is very, very recent example, which is related to terrorism. With the great deal of concern about terrorism, there's been a great concern about illicit nuclear material cutting across national boundaries. And it's with the great trade going around the world, we have huge ships which are going across the world with many, many containers. Those are nothing but, you can see those green boxes and so on. Those are the containers, which are somewhere along 6 by 8 by 18 kind of size of containers here itself. And the concern is that all of these containers are all packed up. Is there any chance that there might be some sort of illicit nuclear material in any one of these? Actually, there have been 18 incidents since 2001 where some of this have been discovered, especially around Russia. And if you go around the world, you will see huge number of Ford security apparatus, billions and billions of dollars, which are being spent to make sure that at least we can detect. So let's examine a little bit about the risk analysis within that context. As I mentioned, that huge number of locations are being used. Just in the United States, all the things you see, there are something like around 57,000 containers per day which are entering border of the United States. And all the ports which are, and airports and everything else, are the ones which have to be protected in some fashion. So one scheme which has been implemented right now is described in the following process. The idea is that every container, before it's loaded on a ship and it lands in the United States, and I'm going to talk about the United States, but the same thing occurs in around the world, including England, there is a custom form. And the custom form, of course, people have to fill out what is the material and what is the weight and everything else. And then who is the vendor, who was the one who is shipping, the name of the company and everything else. So you can maintain a huge amount of database, what are the suspicious companies and so on. And this is called manifest. And they have to be arriving 24 hours in advance to the customs department. The second one is that every container, once it's brought in, it has to go through what is known as a radiation portal. These are nothing but fancy sensors, which are called polyvinyl toluene sensors, PVT sensors. And a truck usually rolls by within this particular portal itself, and then the corresponding measurement of radiation are being made. And the way the system works right now is that manifest and bill of lading is being compared for intelligence. Radiation portal, which is gamma rays based, is also looked at essentially 99.9% of the container. And if they pass, then they pass. If anywhere it fails, then there is going to be stringent inspection. And there would be, this is the major part of the process itself. So how does it work? I'm not going to talk about the manifest data, because that's also a big thing. And there is a lot of interesting problems that comes in terms of unstructured data and so on. But let's just talk about a little bit about radiation portal data. So here is the radiation portal data. What I have is that you have a truck rolling by the sensor here itself. So the highest peak occurs at the center of the container, as you can see in the picture right around to here itself. That's where the highest peak comes in. And what I have is in the blue is nothing but total count in terms of gamma ray count itself. What I have at the below that are nothing but this gamma ray counts are in terms of different energy bands. And so you can break up energy bands in terms of different channels. And what I have is here is where we have around 8 channels which are showing high energy, medium energy, low energy, and so on and so forth. And how do they show up as the truck traverses or container traverses to the radiation portal itself? And vehicle, usually you don't want to have congestion, so you have 20 seconds to drive the container heater itself. And it's collected 0.1 second and so on and so forth. And then what has been the procedure so far has been that you want to take a look at the potentially highest energy. And so what there has been the potential is to look at where the highest energy occurs, total energy occurs. And you can assume that it's nothing but some sort of Poisson process, and you can do a variety of analysis related to that. Unfortunately, obviously, a lot of data is missing here completely because you're just using at the center and you're looking at only top part and you're not looking at any of that. So you're not using full data. And in fact, because of that huge amount of false positive occurs. And here are examples. So kitty litter. So kitty litter actually comes partly from a variety of countries where the clay in the kitty litter turns out to be somewhat radioactive. And you have a truckload of kitty litter, and it turns out that some of the locations, false alarms which were happening, were 34% of them were principally due to kitty litter. So if you just look at total energy, you're just going to go completely crazy. And scouring pads, and you just name it, fertilizers, and because it has potash, and which are maybe radioactive, and ceramic tiles and toilets, and so on and so forth. So a huge number of false positive occurs. So the challenge has been in terms of how can we improve the performance. So I'm just going to give you a couple of quick ideas here, and I'm not going to go through any of the details here itself. First one is that, of course, we saw that we had all these lower bands, medium energy, large energy, and so on and so forth. Would that help us discriminate? So here is data related to background fertilizer and plutonium. And in this particular picture, depending upon how much material you have, fertilizer and plutonium both have total energy which is identical. But if you break it up in terms of only two bands, low energy and high energy, it turns out that you can see in low energy, you have got plutonium, which is higher. Well, for high energy, fertilizer is higher. So if you can differentiate that, you'll be able to discriminate between energy bands in terms of potassium and plutonium here itself, fertilizer and plutonium. Here was another idea, which is related to the whole notion that if you're going to look at only data at only one point, can you look at across the whole time series of 20 seconds here itself? And it turns out that there are a variety of ways where you can see the ratios remain constant. There is an invariance which we have found. And due to invariance, you can combine up and you can come up with a classifier and so on and so forth. And so that's another part which can be done in this particular context. There are still further challenges. If you think that you are able to protect yourself against fertilizer and toilets and so on and so forth, but chances are high that if you are smart enough terrorist, you would mix materials. You're not going to put all of your uranium with just by uranium itself, but you'll mix it with everything else. So there is a whole game theoretic concept comes in. There may be new materials which may be invented and so on. And so there are lots of challenges here. But I just wanted to show you what kind of results come out of it, which is that a new classifier which we have built shows, in fact, that if you have here, there are 29 materials, and each of them are some sort of mixture of very light plutonium, and in that case, also still probability of success, probability of catching them is pretty close to 1. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of idea about careful discrimination and so on. What would it do? This is my last picture, and I'm just going to show this as the last picture here itself. So what is the conclusion would I draw? One is obviously the data, and data is all it is. Data is the most important part of it, and the data quality, data analysis, all of those are critical. Second one is that you really need to break up analysis in terms of more granular analysis. If you're just looking at O-rings or total without looking at temperature and other kind of things, you run into trouble. And same thing happens in terms of nuclear detection data, where if you're just going to look at total frequency band, it won't matter. You get into Simpson's paradox, where in fact the true curve might be going to the right, but if you just collapse it all, it looks like going down instead of up, which is completely opposite reaction you will get. Third one is fuse when you can across different classes of data, lab, partial, qualitative data. Harmonize data with the statistical models. And consider along with all this that risk is nothing but the weakest link. So if you straighten out one link, doesn't mean risk is reduced because there is another link which you have to worry about. So you can't just say that I've fixed this part of it, therefore everything would be fine. You just have to worry about the whole thing.